We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end...
What will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Poetry, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. My name is Philip Lance, and I'm usually a host of New Books in Psychoanalysis, but today I'm venturing into the world of poetry with an interview with Lauren Russell about her book, Descent, published by Tarpaulin Sky Press in 2020. Lauren is the descendant of slave owners. She is also the descendant of slaves. Her book, Descent, is a hybrid work of verse, prose, images, and documents that traverse centuries as the past bleeds into the present. In addition to the book we're talking about today, Descent, Lauren is the author of What's Hanging on the Hush, published by Asata Press, 2017. She has received fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts, Kaveh Kanem, and the Wisconsin Institute for Creative Writing at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. And her work has appeared in various publications, including the New York Times Magazine and the Academy of American Poets' Poem a Day. She was assistant director of the Center for African American Poetry and Poetics at the University of Pittsburgh from 2016 to 2020. In August 2020, she joined the faculty of Michigan State University as an assistant professor in the Residential College in the Arts and Humanities and director of the Residential College's Center for Poetry. So welcome to the program, Lauren.
Thank you, Philip.
And so why don't you kind of introduce this book to us? And one way you might do it, there's a couple epigraphs at the beginning that are really lovely, but however you want to would do it to sort of introduce us to this book.
Yeah, sure. I can start with the epigraphs. So there are two. The first one, which was there from quite an early iteration, is from Eleni Sikelianos's Book of John. And the Book of John starts with this really marvelous introduction, and this is pulled from that part. It matters that there are holes in a family history that can never be filled, that there are secrets and mysteries, migrations and invasions and murky bloodlines. These stories speak of human history. And I had that, I selected that quite early on as I was encountering all these secrets and mysteries and holes that could never be filled that I was attempting to write into. In my own family history, the story begins because I acquired a copy of the diary of my great-great-grandfather, Robert Wallace Hubbert, who was a captain in Hood's Texas Brigade in the Civil War. And after the end of the Civil War, he went back to East Texas and had children by three of his former slaves who were also half-sisters. And one of them was my great-great-grandmother, Peggy Hubbert. And as I was transcribing these 225 pages of diaries, I just became really fascinated by everything that he was leaving out. And that epigraph speaks to holes that can never be filled. And the second one I added later in the process, because I read the book later, which is from Saidiya Hartman's Lose Your Mother. And this one is, I was determined to fill in the blank spaces of the historical record and to represent the lives of those deemed unworthy of remembering. But how does one write a story about an encounter with nothing? And anyone who knows Hartman's work, she's also interested in gaps in the archive. Lose Your Mother is specifically about the transatlantic slave trade and trying to sort of recover the lives of people whose names have been erased, whose stories have been erased. And that particularly spoke to this particular idea of trying to write into that space and capture is the wrong verb. That's interesting. To try to imagine Peggy's voice as a as my great-great-grandmother, as a Black woman who left few records. So much of what I know about Peggy, it's either from the censuses. She appears on 2, 1870 and 1880, and a few mentions in Bob Hubbard's diary where, you know, he mentions her as his cook. So, and that's all. And that's the only record there is. So that was encountering nothing, was trying to find this trace of Peggy's life, and encountering nothing. So that is the question of the book.
Yeah, that's a wonderful way to introduce it, because there's kind of a poetic quality to how you're introducing it with this the poetry of Eleni Sikelianos's language, the secrets and mysteries, migrations and invasions, murky bloodlines. So clearly we're entering into sort of a poetic endeavor here, but it's kind of a historic endeavor, where you're actually like looking into archives and things. So how would you explain this book as poetry, history, what else? How so?
Well, I do think of it as hybrid. And it's actually, you know, says that on it, which I was very happy about on the back of the book. I'm not a historian, and I took pains to note that in the notes that I'm not trained as a historian, I'm trained as a poet. But I also think that allows for a certain kind of freedom, because there's less allegiance to fact. And then that allows for those sort of holes to create space for imaginative work, which in this case I think is kind of a gift, because there's only so much documentation of Peggy's life, as I said, and I can kind of imagine, based on research into the lives of other enslaved, formerly enslaved women in Texas, what her life might have been like and how she might have talked, but I don't know. And I think that having less allegiance to fact and more to imagination sort of creates an opportunity to do that kind of reparative
work. Yeah, I think before you and I started talking, we spoke briefly about, you know, I was saying, is this a history? And I think you said, no, it's not really, it's not history, but it is history. It's not factual history, but if it gives us some sense of some truth that's been about the past, that's been brought to light in this book, I guess we can think of it in history in that sense, that it's disclosing truths about the past, even though they're not factual, but filling in the holes. It seemed like it's very important thing that history should be doing. Mm-hmm. And it seems like, I think there's a good argument to be made that this is a historical work. And a hybrid. And so hybrid, you said you were glad to see that on the back of, I think it's on the back cover, it calls it a hybrid.
It was classified as hybrid / poetry / memoir.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's a really, for people who don't read poetry a lot, which is basically me, I think this is a really good way. Maybe that's why I'm doing New Books in Poetry today instead of my usual New Books in Psychoanalysis, because it's a good way to kind of, you end up immersed in poetry through this book without, but you're drawn in by this intriguing narrative and sort of, and the memoir aspect too. It really weaves together, sort of, you go sort of in and out of poetic passages, painlessly, yeah. You know, because sometimes poetry can be hard for people who aren't really used to reading it often. Is there anything more you want to say about the hybrid nature?
Well, I mean, there's obviously images, documents, you know, pictures of archival documents, photographs. And the narrative arc of the book is formed through this sort of memoir aspect, but I'm a little nervous about calling it that because it's not 100% factual either. but these sort of lyric essays that are about my own life as the descendant slash researcher, my own contemporary life as I was researching my ancestors. And the past sort of converged in the present in interesting ways, you know, as, you know, police violence against Black people continued, as the Black Lives Matter movement grew, as Donald Trump was running for president, I sort of felt the pressure of the past was sort of, the present sort of is a direct result of the past, or, you know, those things became not as separate as I think I had gone into it imagining. And so my own life and my own grappling with that history and with identity and race and legacy sort of became part of the project and became part of the story that weaves around Peggy's story, Bob's story.
Yeah, it's really very relevant in 2020. I don't know, for especially like a lot of white people who sort of woke up and started like researching and learning a lot more about racism because we've been woefully and criminally ignorant for too long. And so it feels very much like a book for 2020. When did you start working on this book?
2013. That was when I got the copies of the diary. It took me a year to type it. Most of the writing I did between 2014 and 2017, but I'd written a few poems in 2013. And I continued sort of tweaking it right up until it went to the printer. So, so 7 years.
When did it go to the printer?
I think like it was April 2020. I think I probably drove my editor nuts because I would keep making small changes like right up until, you know, the deadline to go to the printer.
There's in the beginning, there's a genealogical chart, something I've never seen at the beginning of a book of poetry. Sometimes you see them in historical works, but and it's really useful because, first of all, when you just start at the beginning of the book, you look at it and go, oh no, you begin looking for what was his name? Robert Wallace Hubbard, you pronounced it. That was your great, great grandfather?
Yeah.
Okay. So he was the slave owner. He ended up, how do you say it? Having sex with three of his female slaves who are all half sisters. So I started looking at the chart and then trying to figure out where you fit into it. And there's some interesting things in the chart where there seem to be alliances between people, marriage alliances where you wouldn't expect them to happen. But so I guess you had to create this chart based on...
I created a very ugly one. I have to thank the Joel Coggins... graphic designer made this look good. I did the research to create the chart.
Okay. And then some of that research consisted in, you mentioned spending a year typing up Robert Wallace Hubbard's diary, was it? And was it a handwritten diary, or how did you, so did you have to sort of try to decipher his handwriting?
Yeah, so that was a bit, and as I moved along, I got much better at understanding his handwriting. So yes, it was handwritten, and these are copies of a copy, and the original is lost. So it, some of it, you know, some of it is just impossible, but I was for the most part able to type it.
Okay, so you spent a year before you even get to start writing the book, laboriously typing. Was it a long diary, or how many years of diaries did he keep?
So it was 225 pages, handwritten. It was 1889 through 1894. And then there was a sort of fragment of a diary from 1917. And he died in 1918. I think I'm remembering the years right. So, yeah, so it was from two distinct periods. And the handwriting was harder to read in the later one.
Mm-hmm. How interesting that he kept a diary. I wonder if that was common for men of his class, kind of to keep diaries.
I believe so. And a lot of it is just about the weather. And you know, he was a farmer. So a lot of it is about the weather and what they planted and who came over, who visited. A lot of it is, you know, what completed tasks of the day.
And then let's maybe have you read some more. There's a poem on page 11, the whipper, about a whippoorwill. Mm-hmm. And I guess this one kind of stood out for me because it was the first time I sort of realized, this is more of a typical, a little bit more of a typical poem. And it sort of impressed me. And I don't know, maybe you could read that one and then talk to us about it.
Sure. Heard a whippoorwill holler this morning for the first time this spring. Heard a whippoorwill holler, all hands choking cotton. Heard a holler, a whimper, heard a will whip her. Will heard a whip, whip or will heard, herding hers, whipping herds, sowing oats, whipping whores, stripping cane ore. Whelped her, willed her, a well and a hold, dank of the dark of the hell of the hold, choking cotton, caught in, a yoke and a pull, stripped and caned for. Heard her holler, caught her, held her hand to the, whipped out your, held her head to the, whipped out the billfold. Heard a whimper this spring, choke door. Heard a holler, a hollowed out hold, whipped to a wheelbarrow, hell bent toward a hole, ripped from a, wrapped in a gut wrench sugar hold. Question. So how did the women feel about this? Answer. Don't guess they had no say.
Maybe we should, you could start with the question and the answer. That was actually asked by somebody. Is that
yeah.
Right? One of your relatives.
My father's cousin, who's no longer living, unfortunately. So sort of early in the process, I was just asking him about Peggy and about Peggy being my great-great-grandmother, about her sister, Priscilla. And I sort of asked, you know, how did they feel about this situation? And he sort of said, don't guess they had no say.
Yeah, which is, I don't know, such a wise answer. And so that comes at the bottom. It doesn't, and I guess the link I made to why that was on that page with that poem was because of the whipping. I guess I'm assuming a lot of slave women were whipped, including possibly your great-great-grandma Peggy or great-grandma?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the thing with the language, so what, the language that was actually from the diaries that's in that poem was, heard a whippoorwill holler this morning for the first time this spring, all hands choking cotton, sowing oats, stripping cane. And then the rest of it is me riffing off that language. And it's sort of through the experimentation with sound and meaning with language that I was sort of able to uncover these other resonances beneath the language. So it was like a door through association of sound, through, I don't want to say wordplay because it's very serious, through word work, through working the words. Mm. And I guess I just put that there sort of intuitively. It also comes up in one of the, in a lyric essay that appears a few pages later in the book where you actually get the conversation that it came out of. But whippoorwill throughout the book sort of comes to stand. It reoccurs throughout the book, and it comes to stand for sexual violence. And so I guess that was why that question, why I intuitively juxtaposed that Q&A at the bottom of that poem. I don't know if I'm making sense.
We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night, ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end,
what will I become?
Senua Saga, Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Yeah. So did the line about the whippoorwill and the choking cotton, did that come from the diaries?
Yes. Or,
oh, wow. So that language was right there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, slipping in a little bit of my other life as a psychoanalyst, there's a form of psychoanalysis called Lacanian, which pays very close attention to what the patient and the room says, the exact words they say. You don't listen so much to what they intend to say or mean to say, but the actual words. And I feel like that's what's happening here. You're taking these words and finding associations to them, sometimes rather shocking associations, like to begin with a whippoorwill, which is, I guess, a kind of an actual bird, right?
Yeah, and it sings whippoorwill.
Okay. But then suddenly this turns really dark in some ways here. And when we, in the context of choking cotton, I had never heard that expression. Is that?
I hadn't either, but it was in the diary. So, and I don't understand much, honestly, about farming or cotton cultivation. I probably should have looked at, I don't honestly understand what that means, but it's a very evocative as an expression. Kind of influenced by the poet Harriet Mullen, who does a lot of this punning and sort of associative, it's like getting associative riffing off language. And she's influenced by Gertrude Stein. So it is kind of a way of working with language that's part of a tradition. Mm-hmm. But I did feel like in this case, it was almost like revealing something beneath this sort of very quotidian, very banal report of, like, you know, farming and hearing a whippoorwill, that this happens in this context of this other history. So that's sort of, I think, where I'm coming from.
Yeah. On the theme of sexual violence, I hadn't thought of that phrase exactly in terms of this book, but later in the book too, you talk about in Texas, there was a law that it was illegal. How do you pronounce it? Miscegenation?
Miscegenation.
Okay. For a white man to marry a woman of color, or vice versa, a woman, that was illegal, but it wasn't illegal for a white man to have sex with a black woman. That you could get away with, oftentimes with terrible consequences for the black woman. But it was illegal to get married. that was the way you framed that too was quite.
Well, that was interesting because that was, I'm trying to find that page. It was a convention of colored men of Texas. That they were trying to get the law changed, which of course didn't happen, but they were trying to make it illegal. They were trying to make interracial sex as illegal as interracial marriage, which of course didn't happen. Why can't I find this page where that was? But of course the reverse, you know, if a black man had been having a relationship with a white woman, you know, he would have been killed. So there are multiple double standards there.
Yeah. That's a very illuminating historical sort of context that it was a group of colored men in Texas who were advocating for these laws and apparently didn't get very far. There's another, let's see, section on page I was interested in, page 32, where the color blue comes up. Maybe I'll read the first two lines. No, is it page 32? Yeah, in Bob Hubbard's diaries, the silences speak louder than what's said. So I developed a practice of reading for absence, you say. So can you say more about reading for absence? Oh, this isn't my question about blue. Because, oh, that comes right before this. Yeah, I wanted to get that. Yeah, so the poem on page 32, is that a poem? It's a large chunk of text. How would you describe that passage? And what does blue have? How did blue come in here?
Yeah, it's a prose poem, as a lot of the poems in the book are. And I developed that actually in a workshop as a, this was a recommendation of my fellow at the Wisconsin Institute for Creative Writing, Meg Wade, who I think I had maybe started writing these prose blocks. And then she was like, this form works really well because it's sort of strangling, the content. They're very constrained, right? These justified prose blocks. So blue, honestly, I arrived at blue because I'm associated with red. I mean, I wear red a lot. And in my prior book, there's a woman in red throughout the whole book who's very closely associated with me. And I didn't want to confuse Peggy with myself or because the easiest thing to write a character is to have the character be you, right? So I was trying to avoid doing that. So I gave her a distinct color, which is blue. I don't know. Did you want me to read that one?
Sure.
Peggy rises out of sleep through the dream called blue, where all her kinfolks are wading through fields of blue. Even her father left in Georgia, her stillborn brother somehow grown, her niece who stumbled into the fire on Christmas Day and died with the vision of her white dress aflame, the aunt or uncle who ran off or was lost forever to the auction block. They are all wearing blue, blue hats, blue shawls, and in the way they sing a song with no words deep from the gut, there is also blue. And bluely she creeps toward them in her calico blue. And now there is a dance. They are partnering for the quadrille. And the man they called Bo Peep cradles a banjo, strikes a tune blue. And her petticoat starched with hominy water and prisses too. And every time they stop moving for a second, the petticoats pop and Priss giggles. And in Priss's eyes are flecks of blue. The log train shakes her into waking, black then dark blue. And she reaches for her kerchief blue, and she is stumbling toward the cradle blue and cooing shoo shoo to the baby who is hollering now. One Sunday, the preacher prayed, Lord, let us all go to heaven where there'll be no log train. Hoo hoo hoo, and a clankety clank, hoos, black smoke curling into the half blue. I was a respondent on a panel about blues in verse a few years ago, and I realized in preparing the response, and I actually read this poem, that it sort of had these qualities of blues, I mean, including like the train, the presence of the train. And I think that although I wasn't thinking about it when I picked that color, the way the blues is both sorrow and joy, the sort of emotional nuance of the blues, I guess, is also pertinent here. So there's another way in which that color resonates.
Yeah. It really evokes a scene in time, I feel like. I'd have to look at it again, but it seems like this is sort of something happening in a moment, and there's some music and dance and banjos and petticoats and quadrille dancing. So somehow it feels like it gives us a little glimpse into a moment in time in a slave's life, or somebody who had been a slave. I wanted to say something else about that, but maybe this is where the question about joy comes in, because in your acknowledgments you acknowledge something, I don't have it in front of me, about how maybe in writing these kind of works, you tell me if I got this right or wrong, but one wouldn't want just for it to be about slavery as a state of abjection, but that there was,
yeah,
there could also be joy.
Yeah, and actually that poem was directly in response to that. So yeah, that's a good connection. Mm-hmm. So that was from Lyra Van Cleef Stefanon. I hope I'm not butchering her name, but she was she's a poet on the faculty of the Kaveh Kanem Retreat for Black Poets. One of the summers I was there, and she gave us, I think the exercise was called "Let Me Has Been" or something, but she specifically had us think about joy throughout history, in Black history, and it so happened that week was the week that the the massacre in the Black church in Charleston, mm-hmm. and she sort of made the point, like, look at everything that's going on now, and Kaveh Kanem is in it too, this space for Black poetry. And so, yeah, and she was the one who said, like, don't buy into narratives of abjection. And I think that was a really interesting challenge to imagine how Peggy might have experienced moments of joy and pleasure or delight within the constraints of her life. And if the other big influence in thinking about that is Alice Walker's essay, In Search of Our Mother's Gardens, where she talks about Black women throughout history exercising their creativity within the constraints of their lives. And she uses as an example her mother, who was a sharecropper, who had extraordinary gardens. And her gardens were works of art, and people would come all over to see them. And that was how she practiced her creativity. And so I sort of found ways to sort of imagine both joy and creativity. It's sort of an act of agency in Peggy's life.
I think it's really important. It's making me think, one of the books I read this year was it by Carol Anderson? She's a historian, Black historian, White Rage. And it's a very important book. Probably a lot of people know it, but it's very difficult to read because it's kind of a chronicle of atrocity after atrocity committed by white people on Black people. And I like this this other way of trying to look into Black history too, that you're doing in this book. And maybe we should, this is where I guess I could ask my question about the your practice of reading for absence. Can you say more about that?
So that's on the next page you were looking at, I think.
Yeah, page 33.
Yeah, so I was talking about, that was sort of specifically within the context of the diaries. And like I said, I became really fascinated by what was being left out, because Bob Hubbert would talk, quite a lot about his kids, but never mentioned they were his kids, including his son, Plunk, Lively Plunk, who is obviously very close to, and we actually have a picture, the picture's in the book, of him with Plunk. And he was working with him on the farm, like, all the time. You know, and there was actually one entry written by Plunk in Hubbard's diary, but he never says it's his kid, or that any of his children are his children. Although he'd say, like, he'd point out who his white relatives were. He would say, like, my niece or my brother, who, you know, he would say who they were in relation to him. And Peggy, he mentions, is that she used to be my cook. Priscilla, her sister, he mentions, Pris Thorpe, a number of times, who had also had children by him. And he never says who they are to him or, like, why he's spending all this time with this, you know, Plunk. And I think I was really fascinated by that, partly. And so it was, I did feel like what wasn't being said was actually saying more in a way than what was being said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's another moment later in the book where, what was it, an obituary of Hubbard's, where it says that he was married to a white, his first wife, who was white.
It's not really an obituary, because it actually was like 20 years ago.
Oh, uh-huh.
The sons of Confederate veterans decided to rebury. When I first heard the story, I didn't believe it, but it turned out to be true. They decided to rebury Bob's remains and his first wife, though there wasn't really very much left at that point to rebury. But anyway, they had this whole ceremony around it. And in the newspaper, the local coverage of this ceremony or this event is what you're referring to. It says, Virginia, Captain Hubbard's wife, died as a result of childbirth, and he lamented her death and never remarried for the remainder of his life. And by the time I read that, like, that was kind of late in my my research and my, like, I was, it shouldn't have been, I was surprised, and it made me really angry to read that, because none of this should have been surprising at that point. Mm-hmm. But I felt like in writing Peggy out, like, it wrote, or this, the article wrote me out, or wrote my whole family out of, mm-hmm. of, it's like, we don't exist then. and I found that pretty infuriating.
Yeah, that's really shocking. Peggy, I guess, lived her entire life with this man pretty much until she died, as far as we know, or until he died, I guess.
I don't know. She, so in the 1880 census, they're living as one household. And really interestingly, their children are listed as his. And as, so, you know, he's listed as white, she's listed as black, and then all their children are listed as his children in relationship to the head of household. And are listed as mulatto. So I actually thought that was pretty interesting, because he acknowledged them for that purpose, apparently, and actually acknowledged his daughters, and that he sent them all to school. And the story was that at least his daughters by Peggy, except for one who chose not to go. But my grandfather's story was always that he sent them all to school because he didn't want them working in no white man's kitchen, because he knew what would happen then. As he did, obviously. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I don't know that if Peggy lived with him for the rest of her life. In the diaries, which are in the early, like the 1889 through 1894, it seems like she has her own place. Like, he would say, he mentions going to Peggy's to do various things. Like, he bore her a well and plant things there. So I'm not sure, like, where exactly she was, if it was a little spot on his land, or I'm not sure about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. On the subject of people being left out, I actually, at the beginning of your book, you talk about one of your, Bob's ancestors was married to somebody else who had an estate. Was it called Turnwald, a famous estate?
And it was Bob's sister was married to a descendant of the family, but yeah.
And that estate, that plantation, for some reason I was interested, and I looked it up, and I found a passage which talked about this plantation and these white people who had made it into one of the greatest plantations in the South. And I was thinking, it wasn't the white people who made it a great plantation. Mm. It was all the slaves who made that, who turned it into a wealthy, but they were left out of it. Just, I don't know, more to your point.
So I read that that plantation, or rather the enslaved people who lived there, were the source of the Uncle Remus stories. And the guy who wrote it had, now I can't remember, worked there or visited there or been there in some capacity. Mm. Then later I talked to a scholar who said nobody really knew where those stories came from. So I don't know if that's true or not, but I think it's an interesting
anecdote. It would add another way in which the plantation, the plantation was made great, not just economically, but literarily through possibly the Uncle Remus stories, because of the Black people who lived there. Well, speaking of Black people and white people, let's see, which page is this? Page 50. I really liked how, I guess this would be like a memoir kind of section a little bit, but you kind of poetically sort of reference your own identity. And at one point, I think there's a couple, I'll just quote you, quote, "In Madison, I became Black." And then on the same page, you say, "Aren't I a white girl on the phone?" And it's because your mother was white and your father was Black. And there's an interesting way you play with identity here in a very poetic way, where it seems like almost under some social context, you appear as Black, and another social context, like being on the phone, you appear as white. Do you want to say anything about that section?
I guess when I was talking earlier about how sort of the present converged with the past, this was sort of one of the places where I felt like that happened. And the context for that in that essay, I was writing right after the killing of Tony Robinson, who was an unarmed Black teenager who was killed by a Madison police officer. And I was living in Madison, Wisconsin at the time. And I found out somewhere in the reportage, they were calling him the unarmed Black man. And then at some point it was revealed that he had a white mother. And I also have a white mother. And for, I think, a lot of my life, I felt like race, or the way I inhabit race, is contextual or geographic almost. Hmm. You know, I know you from LA, where I think I was sort of an ethnically ambiguous brown person, and the same when I lived in New York City. And in Pittsburgh is a bit different, because Pittsburgh is more of a Black and white predominantly city with fewer other people. Hmm. And Madison was a very extreme version of that, because Madison is extremely white. And I gotta be honest, I really did not like living there. I think it's pretty apparent in the book, but it was very, very white. And I think that was, I don't know how another way to say it. In Madison, I've become Black, where it became inescapable, I guess, because that's sort of what that essay is about, inescapability. But I also say later, the right to Blackness always felt unearned, which is where I get into the question of, aren't I a white girl on the phone? And in fact, I went to a doctor, I guess this was a few years ago. I like made a doctor's appointment on the phone for a new ophthalmologist or something. And I got to the appointment, and without asking my race, they had just checked off white. They assumed based on my voice that I was white. Mm-hmm. So I know that. So I think it is, the way I inhabit race is kind of contextual. And I think in recent years, I felt both sort of more included in Blackness. And this was partly because of Kaveh Khanum, that retreat for Black poets, because there were so many ways of being a Black poet represented there. But also, like, and it's partly this question of geography, like, it's not something you really get to choose. So yeah, so I'm not sure if I'm answering your question.
Yeah, I think it's you're touching on just a really interesting question about identity and the long debates about is Black an essential character, or is it a socially constructed? Is race socially constructed or essential? But you do it so in this beautiful poetic way. I mean, there's very little text on these pages, but what's there is beautiful, and it really goes to the heart of this question. I want to move on. Yeah, or what do you want to say?
I was going to say that was one of the more painful parts to write, I think, because I sort of very openly talk about my own internalized racism, and it's one thing to sort of talk about the past, and another thing to sort of expose one's own inner struggles with these issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there's another sort of exposure of inner sort of issues, which I'll keep in mind what you said at the beginning, that the memoir, you hesitate to call it a memoir because in the same way it's not exactly history, the memoir isn't always, I guess what you meant was factually exact, but there's a passage on page 67. This gets to a question about trauma, but I'm going to read this paragraph, I think. My lover left me because I was impossible to read. I think I would have fallen in love with you, she said, if I could see my emotions reflected on your face. I am as inscrutable as chalk. The lover who left me is white. She studies epigenetics, which suggests that external factors can affect gene expression. The question of ancestral trauma looms large. I wanted to reach for those scars, parentheses, cards, but did not. How many centuries on the auction block? So there's a lot here, but I guess I just wanted to point out one thing I liked was how you weave in and out of your own story, your own almost sort of confessional expressions. But then we get to this question of how trauma can be transmitted across generations, how many centuries on the auction block. And that really struck me as a psychologist. What are the effects when you have generations of people who've been on the auction block? How does that, the consequences of that reverberate into the present, bleeds into the present, I guess, it speaks in your...
Especially since it's not very many generations. If if you think about that.
Uh-huh. You mean not many generations ago.
Right. Yeah. Between me and Peggy, that's not a lot of generations.
Yeah. Yeah. Peggy was your great, great grandmother.
Right. My grandfather's grandmother. So.
Uh-huh. Let's see. We've got to sort of move towards closing here, but I think there was something I was curious about I wanted to hit on before we close, which was in the acknowledgments. And this was an interesting poetic volume because I found myself reading everything, including the notes, end notes, I guess you call them, and then the acknowledgement, pages and pages of acknowledgements, but that were extremely readable and sort of, I don't know, felt like I was carrying on somehow the body of the book all the way through to the end of the acknowledgments. But one of the acknowledgments, you mentioned that a woman named Tana Welch, who gave you some comments on the next to final draft, resulted in a better ending for the book mm-hmm. and made you consider, quote, despite my best intentions, I continue to perpetuate the very frameworks I am so intent on resisting. So what were these frameworks you were attempting to resist?
So I sent her a full draft of the manuscript just as I was preparing to send it to publishers. And I'd already written a cover letter, everything. And originally the book ended on Bob it ended on, there's a prose poem that's opposite the photograph of Bob and Plunk. It's on page 86. And that had always, and it's from Bob's perspective. And that had always been the ending. Like I wrote it in maybe 2014, and that was the ending till 2018. And Tana was like, isn't this Peggy's book? Shouldn't it end on Peggy? And I was like, oh my gosh. So I reordered the ending and it ends on a poem in Peggy's voice now, which is much more appropriate and much more powerful. So that was, and that was it. That was the framework. Like the whole book, I'm trying to imagine Peggy's voice and Peggy's life and sort of give her space. And yet I was going to and give Bob the last word.
Yeah. It's so hard not to fall into these being structured by contexts. And Bob was the one who wrote and wrote diaries and wrote the history, so to speak. And is extremely influential in how we resist the written words and try to get beyond them. Anyway, this, you did so well in this book. Maybe just to end, there's a beautiful cover. Can you tell us about the cover image on the book?
Yeah, that was by the artist Sarah Stefana Smith, who I met at a residency in 2018. And her work is really interested in, I mean, she does these, she calls them abstract, which I guess just means non-representational, but to poet means something different. So we have a lot of conversations about that because it seems quite concrete to me. It's, you know, you can touch it. But anyway, she makes these abstract installation pieces sort of around lines of demarcation around race and the history of race is sort of haunting and embodiment. And that I found that when I saw her work, like she just had an open studio at the residency that like our work was really in conversation and we started talking about it. And we started working toward a future installation in conversation with dissent. Actually, this is not from that. This is an earlier work, but we started working on it right before everything shut down. Our work was interrupted by COVID, but I think she's been independently making some pieces. So hopefully in the future, when it's possible to reconvene, we'll be able to resume work on that and install it somewhere eventually. Yeah, so that she's the artist.
And on the inside cover of your book, or it says, I guess the title of the piece is Mend 2018 from series A/mends materials, black bird netting, fishing line, and black thread. And it's the cover of your book is black and white. It's mostly a white cover with this, this image on it. And then the words Lauren Russell Dissent. And incredibly beautiful book. I'm so honored to be able to sort of talk to you about it and so glad we had the chance. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Philip. Thanks for inviting me.
You've been listening to an interview with Lauren Russell about her book Dissent here at New Books in Poetry, a channel on the New Books Network. Feel free to contact me at Philip J. Lance, Philip has one L, @gmail.com to let me know your thoughts and questions about the show. Thanks for listening.